and welcome to Rabble Radio. It's Friday, July 7th, 2023. I'm your host, Brianne Doyle. Thanks so much for tuning in. Rabble's got its finger on the beat of the issues that matter to you. If you're curious about the latest news in Canadian politics, labor, environment, or social justice, you've come to the right place. This is news for the rest of us, free of corporate influence. This week on Rabble Radio, we share a segment from our most recent episode of the Courage My Friends podcast series, hosted on Needs No Introduction. In this episode of the Courage My Friends podcast series, host Resh Badu sits down with Anna Guillera Murren and Dara Wawati Chabot of Iron and Earth. The three discuss what a just transition can look like for those working and living in Canada's oil patch and for Indigenous communities. Anna Guillera Murren is the community's director and just transition lead at Iron and Earth. She began her social and environmental justice career in Colombia, listening to and empowering oil, gas, and mining workers through forming partnerships and understanding worker issues. Dara Wawachi Chabot is the Indigenous lead researcher at Iron and Earth and is a single parent who studies political science full-time at the University of Ottawa. They support their small family by creating art and working remote contracts, fighting for environmental justice in so-called Canada. The Courage My Friends podcast series is presented by Rabble.ca and the Tommy Douglas Institute at George Brown College, with the support of the Douglas Coldwell Leighton Foundation. Here is a small clip from our most recent Courage My Friends episode. Take a listen.
Anna and Dara, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Let's start with you, Anna. Tell us about Iron and Earth and your role.
Iron Earth started in the oil sands in Alberta, where some workers were concerned about one of the many boom and busts of the industry cycle. And they were also concerned about what they were seeing with the environment. So we started this organization in 2016. And one of the founders stayed with the organization until 2021. And then 2021 started like a new version, or an updated version, I would call it, of Iron Earth. So with the new leadership, I came along. I am the community's director and just transition lead.
And who are your primary stakeholders? What groups are you working with?
Well, that's a great question, because right now we're in the middle of expanding our mandate. So our mission and vision, and what you can find on the website right now, is to empower fossil fuel workers and Indigenous workers to build and implement the climate solutions required to transition. My title is Communities Director. It's kind of interesting, because a lot of times when we talk about workers, we talk about them in the vacuum. And it's not just the workers, the worker, their family. When a refinery shuts down in a town, that affects commerce, education, churches. It affects everything. So we started looking at a little bit more systematic and like more comprehensive. And that went in the same way with Indigenous workers. It's like, well, obviously, there are Indigenous peoples that participate in the transition, but there are other Indigenous peoples across nations and urban centers that are being impacted one way or another by this transition, by climate change. So we are currently in the process of doing that internal work. Our audience right now is workers, their communities, and Indigenous peoples across nations and urban centers.
And speaking of Indigenous workers and Indigenous communities, Dara, you are the lead Indigenous researcher with Iron and Earth. So could you tell us a bit more about your role?
So I'm the Indigenous lead researcher. And while the title really portrays the fact that I work from an Indigenous perspective, given that I'm Algonquin Anishinaabe, I have grown up on the land with my family, and I have that relationship with my communities that I'm from. But it really just represents the fact that to do any of this work in a just way requires acknowledging the history that Canada has socially, historically, economically, with Indigenous peoples across this land. So what that means for me is that for community work, these relationships are our primary focus. We don't just meet with Indigenous people, you know, we meet with politicians, educators, community leaders, different organizers, and frontline activists so that we can assess the needs of everyone living in so-called Canada. And the principles around this are really just to highlight the holistic nature of the work that we do. And ensuring a future for all really does mean for all. It's not exclusive.
And we're going to go back a bit more into those principles and how they are operationalized through these partnerships with Iron and Earth. But you mentioned, Anna, that Iron and Earth was founded in 2016 by workers from the Alberta oil patch, or those working in the oil sands. And that was also the year of the Fort McMurray wildfire that led to Alberta's largest wildfire evacuation. Was that also sort of a motivating factor in the founding or beginnings of Iron and Earth?
I can't tell you specifically if the wildfire was a factor. The workers that were thinking about building Iron Earth were thinking about all the environmental impacts they were seeing. So I think, if I'm allowed to extrapolate, it definitely supported that idea, if not maybe led it, I would say.
Because the reason that I'm asking is I remember videos of those wildfires, people driving through, and it looked like they were driving through hell. And right now, wildfires are raging across the country. Nova Scotia is going through a nightmare. Last week in Toronto, where I am right now, we made the world's top 10 list for worst air quality. So this is an accelerating climate crisis where we're breaking records every year. And so moving to a clean energy economy is therefore a necessity. Is this feeling shared by oil and gas workers more widely? I know they are certainly by those who founded this organization, but is this a growing feeling among workers in those sectors? Are you seeing more of a buy-in to the need to transition?
Well, I can tell you in January of 2022, we hosted our first sort of community session with our new community engagement model. We hosted that session in Hinton, Alberta. So about half of our participants were workers in the extractive industries, forestry, coal, and oil and gas. Hinton is very diversified on those aspects. And it was very interesting because they had gone through a 2021 big dry season that led to forest fires. And so what people were seeing then and now, they're seeing the impacts and how they're affecting them in an economic way, like how much it affects their expenses. Another thing we saw, and I think this is quite important, is that workers were indicating that their companies, I will just kind of paraphrase what someone once said, we had to create like a firefighter brigade, and we had to create some sort of procedures to protect our company and our production against forest fires. And this, I think, is something that we see across Canada. It's been left to companies and to people, and there hasn't been a comprehensive or supportive pan-Canadian weight of this is how you mitigate, this is what you need to do with regards to forest fire. Mm-hmm. We've seen people related to economic impacts. We see people related to how their workplace gets affected, but we see a lot of ad hoc solutions.
And where, again, the burden is being placed on the workers themselves. Are you working with organized labor on this as well, the union movement?
So for us, Iron Earth, we believe that one of the key points required to transition is to have well-paying union jobs. It's the only way we can entice workers that are making a lot of money in the oil and gas field to other industries, right? So unions are a big component of what we see as a just transition. Mm-hmm. We do have conversations with unions and we do try to work together. I personally like to work from a collaborative perspective. And so all of our approaches ever since I started in Iron Earth have been like, okay, what's the union movement doing? So yeah, I think one of the main messages that is coming from the union movement is that they have the workers required to transition, right? That's their response to a lot of what the companies and governments are saying, for sure.
Right. Just to mention that a couple of weeks ago, we had Jamie Kirkpatrick from Blue Green Canada, who was really talking about this consolidated union effort that is being put forth. Yeah, within a just transition. So Iron and Earth is about transitioning workers, as you say, communities and industry toward meeting the national climate targets of reaching net zero or carbon neutrality by 2050. And a major focus is on training and transferring skills of oil and gas workers to renewable energy sectors. So give us an idea of this. What types of skills transfer are we talking about, Anna?
One of the things that we're doing with the expansion of the mandate is to lower the barriers to transition more than like transitioning the workers. So I just want to do that little bit of an intro, because a lot of times, oh, so you're a training institution. It's interesting how the conceptions can go. Mm-hmm. But I would say that from the skill perspective, a lot of times electricians, people that are in those trades are fairly easy to transition. A lot of times unions already are offering that kind of skill transferability. I think something that a lot of people don't really see is that, for example, a driller in the oil and gas or oil sands can be a driller in other mining industries. The size of the drill might be a little bit different, but you still can do the job fairly easy. An electrician is needed anywhere, right? So I think it's more about what the pay is and what kind of benefits you can get from moving from one company to another. We know, for example, there are certain companies that don't even require that you graduate high school to go into this kind of jobs. So obviously, it's a low barrier participation industry that attracts a lot of people. So what we're trying to do is like, hey, you have the skills are very good and they can help you a lot. And maybe we can figure out a way how you can transition. But the model that Iron Earth is trying to go about is to meet people where they're at. So basically have conversations one-on-one with participants and assess, so what do you want to do? Right. Because a lot of times the other problem is choice. People don't have choices. We're just like, oh, you have to transition from this economy to this economy. And people are like, what? I just want to retire, you know?
Yeah. One thing that comes to mind for me when I think about workers and what I've read and what I've heard from people so far is climate anxiety and the mental health crisis and how it's going to really impact people and families and relationships and how we navigate life day to day. And what we really need to do is provide people with stories of hope and inspiration. And like Anna said, like making avenues that remove these barriers to participation that really allow for people to feel like they belong in this movement.
So what are some of the key or the major barriers that people are experiencing in moving forward with a just transition?
Well, I can start a little bit talking about what Iron Earth does. Barriers are quite individual. So for instance, Resh, you and I are immigrants. So we face different kind of barriers than someone that's indigenous or someone that is fully born Canadian, right? Someone that finished high school, someone that actually has a graduate degree or an undergraduate degree, right? So like the way we're trying to see about it is to put it back on the person. So what is it that you need and what is that you want? We're trying to utilize harm reduction methods and models of care that have been used frontline in public health care, like the overdose epidemic, all that kind of public health awareness and work that a lot of amazing people are doing on the ground. And we're trying to utilize some of those concepts into this work, because it is about caring for one another. I think one of the biggest conclusions I got from the people's response to the COVID pandemic and other reactionary processes have happened in the past few years is that people feel, and this is a big word, feel that they're not being taken into consideration. They feel they are not being heard. They feel that they are outside of what's going on with the world, right? And so what we're trying to challenge is that feeling, and it's really difficult. I work in program delivery with Iron Earth. I work, again, more on the engagement piece. But a lot of times what I hear from my counterparts at the program delivery is like, well, actually, someone just needed a little bit of talk and talk to a mentor. And they felt like, oh, my God, OK, there's so many things I can do. Right. There's a lot of, I don't know if it's fear, but it's more like it's the unknown. And, yeah, you know, we as humans kind of are difficult to move from things that we don't understand or that we don't know. We're not good at changing.
Iron and Earth is also engaging in projects with Indigenous communities. What are some of these projects right now, Dara?
So currently, we have a few projects going on, actually. So Iron and Earth has many different sectors where we have different things going on. We have a climate careers portal, which is something entirely different from my work, and that involves Indigenous peoples on its own front. I am in charge of the Indigenous research component for the communities and just transition envisioning. And the work that I'm planning on doing is really just trying to amplify the voices of Indigenous communities where we see the long-term impacts of these clean energy projects, they're called. So solar projects, for example, something is built on a community, what happened 10 years later? Because we are in that process now of tracking and really seeing what the impact of clean energy is having in communities. So that's really what we're trying to do, is bring these stories to the front and remind people that this technology is not new. And we do have power as a collective, and we just need to work together to amplify those voices. People feel disempowered politically, socially, in so many ways, right? Especially from the pandemic, like Anna was saying, people didn't feel heard. People didn't feel listened to or respected. And as much friction or conflict that that may have caused in society, what I want to take is those lessons that we can use to build onto a more collaborative future. Like, what do people want? And they want to feel involved. They want to feel like they belong to this new world that we're going to create.
There's so many communities that are going through this. But when we're looking at, you know, Indigenous communities, because they play a particular role, so many resources, whether it is the old coal-based resources or the renewable resources, are by and large found on Indigenous lands all over the world, not just in Canada. And historically, when it's come to, again, resource-based industries in Canada, fossil fuels, also forestry, fishing, the list goes on, the relationship between industry and many Indigenous communities have been less than stellar, to put it very lightly. In many cases, it's been downright exploitative. So what has been going wrong and what needs to change going forward? What transition needs to happen there in terms of how industry works with Indigenous communities?
Well, based on the research that we've been doing so far, listening to what people have to say who are already talking about these things, economic reconciliation is a word that comes up a lot. You can call it a buzzword, you can call it whatever you want, but I think it's really important to think about the way that these concepts will have very real impacts on the ways that legislation and policy are going to be written, the way that research is going to be conducted, the types of statistics that are going to be kept track of. And all of these things feed into each other, right? And so for me, with my background from working in the federal government as a public servant, there is such a lack of collaboration, I guess. And as an Indigenous person, what I see is just these hierarchical bureaucratic systems being recreated over and over again, trying to find solutions that these very systems created, I wouldn't say problems, but gaps. Mm-hmm. And I think from what I've experienced in my own journey as a researcher, as an academic, as an activist, this comes from one of my teachers, actually, and it's that there can be many truths, and then there's still like that objective truth. And we have to, as people, acknowledge our own positions and where we are at as humans and just let go of that ego and be willing to sit at the table and be willing to be wrong and be willing to continue that conversation. What I say to people all the time when they challenge me, you know, well, you can't make everybody disagree. And like, well, everybody could also just be a little bit unhappy. That's the concept of compromise, is that we each give a little bit so that we can get a little bit. And that's sustainability, right? That's reciprocity. And the law of reciprocity is something that is lacking within the current economic system. Mm-hmm. All human beings would benefit from the implementation of principles like this, ensuring that people are taken care of. For example, we see the benefits of providing people with childcare for the duration of their prenatal and postpartum periods. Like, that would totally eradicate the need for a childcare system. That would solve so many issues if we just took care of parents first and foremost and allowed them that time to situate themselves in the world as a family. That would have positive impacts as well on different things like healthcare issues, on family dynamics, and just being able to take that time to heal, right? And so for me, like, we have to heal our families as much as we have to heal our governments. We have to walk the talk. And so I have seen that ideological shift towards economic practices like eliminating food waste, plastic use, or the need for certain unsustainable materials overall. And a lot of that change is being collaboratively led by Indigenous and non-Indigenous people, because we need resources, we need time, we need capacity. And those are all things.
Was Courage My Friends podcast series host Resh Badu with Anna Guerra Marin and Dara Wawachi Chabot from Iron and Earth. If you want to hear the full version of this episode and want to check out even more great conversations from this series, please subscribe to Needs No Introduction, a podcast by Rabble, which presents a series of speeches and lectures from the finest minds of our time. Available on rabble.ca, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and more. Switching gears now, here is Rabble editor Nick Seabrook to catch us up on the top news stories of the week in a segment we like to call In Case You Missed It. Take it away, Nick.
Thanks, Brianne. In labor news, port workers in Vancouver, BC, represented by the International Longshore and Warehouse Union of Canada, continue to strike to protect unionized labor. The union represents more than 7,000 port workers at 30 ports across the province. The strike action began on Saturday, July 1st, after they were unable to reach a collective agreement with their employer, the British Columbia Maritime Employers Association. At issue is the contracting out of labor to non-unionized workers. The association has said that contracting out is necessary because the union has been unable to fulfill the trades work that they have jurisdiction over, an allegation that the union has said is not true. Union President Rob Ashton said, quote, "It is an unwillingness of the employers to properly utilize our trades workers. We have already have the sufficient numbers of registered trade workers to meet the demands of the industry, and we continue to recruit more," end quote. In other labor news, a slate of candidates is running for the leadership of the Ontario Federation of Labor. Dubbed Team Ignite, educational assistant Laura Walton, grocery store clerk Ahmad Gade, and union educator and community worker Jackie Taylor are running for president, secretary treasurer, and executive vice president, respectively. Walton, who is currently the president of the Ontario School Board Council of Unions, led a historic labor action on behalf of her members against the Ontario provincial government, Premier Doug Ford, last fall. In an interview with Rabble.ca this week, Walton said, quote, "I'm always going to be an education worker and a worker first. The one thing I recognized is that when education workers needed the labor movement was there for us," end quote. Walton went on to explain that the core message of her campaign was greater transparency, communication, and treating workers as holistic beings. In provincial politics, national politics reporter Stephen Wenzel explains how New Brunswick Premier Blaine Higgs remains under fire for his discriminatory policy 713, which targets trans and non-binary youths in that province. Under his policy, parental consent will be required for trans or non-binary students under the age of 16 to have their chosen name used in classrooms. Otherwise, their dead name will continue to be used. The policy states that if consent cannot be obtained from parents, the students will be forced to meet with a school social worker or psychologist in order to develop a plan to speak with their parents if and when they are ready to do so. This stipulation baselessly assumes that students are not asking for consent, rather than parents being unwilling to provide it. Critics of the policy state that it puts an already vulnerable community at even further risk. In Indigenous news, national politics reporter Scott Martin explores the controversy that continues to surround the Assembly of First Nations and their elected national chief, Roseanne Archibald, who a majority of regional chiefs voted to remove at a virtual meeting last month. On the one side, Archibald said that she is being targeted for attempting to clean up corruption in the organization. The Assembly, however, states that she has harassed and bullied Assembly employees. Pam Palmiter, professor and chair of Indigenous governance at Toronto Metropolitan University, said in a recent panel on the Aboriginal People's Television Network that she believes that it was not a legal removal and that Archibald is still national chief. She later added that the solution was for chiefs to take charge in the National Assembly taking place later this month. And finally, Rabble contributor John Miller explained how a possible merger between the company that owns the Toronto Star and newspaper giant Post Media could mean the death of local newspapers in Canada. Post Media is currently saddled with $261 million in debt and pays more than $31 million a year to service that debt. Miller explained that mergers like this one often result in the closure of newspapers and the firing of journalists. As always, you can find the full version of these stories and much, much more on Rabble.ca.
Rabble.ca shares news for the rest of us. We believe news for the rest of us is about creating a more informed and connected world. Help Rabble.ca make quality, progressive news and views accessible to all. Become a Rabble Rouser today and support us during our summer fundraiser with a one-time or monthly donation.
And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thanks as always for tuning in. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to our show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please rate, review, share Rabble Radio with your friends. It takes 2 seconds to support independent media like Rabble. If you have feedback for the show, ideas, stories, opinions you'd like us to cover, we'd love to hear about it. Get in touch with us anytime at editor@rabble.ca. Do you want to share Rabble Radio on your campus, college, or community radio station? It's easy. To find out more information on how your local radio station can become a host for Rabble Radio, please email us at editor@rabble.ca. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on Rabble.ca, and thank you to Carl Nirenberg for supplying the music. Lastly, thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week.